Talk a little bit about that year, how it went, and then move us forward to going to spring training the first time with with the Braves. That must have been exciting.
Sure was. I relate to hurting my elbow is that I went to spring training with the Braves, and that was during the war years, and we trained in San Antonio. And the only club that we played were the St. Louis Browns. So we used to travel through Mexico and wherever playing the Browns. And I got an opportunity to pitch. And I was hoping against hope that the club would keep me because I didn't have a major league contract. But really they wanted somebody to pitch batting practice and I was one of those people. So I went to Evansville. And I won 19 and lost 5. And we won our division, and we played Springfield, which I think was the Cardinal Ball Club. And I think we got beat, Decatur. And I pitched the ball game. Bob Coleman came to me and asked me if I wanted to try to win my 20th. And I think Tommy Bridges was the only guy that ever won 20 in that league. And I said, sure. And I lost the game 2-1. That a ground ball went by our third baseman, Don Gutteridge. It's not Don Gutteridge, but anyway. And after the game was over, he gave the hitters heck for not giving more support. Mm-hmm. He was pulling for me to win 20 more than I won.
Yeah.
And but I wound up 19-6, and I think I had a 1 point something ERA, and I had a great year.
And the elbow never bothered you again?
Never bothered me again.
Warren, talk about how you, let's say you pitch today. Talk about your routine, even in those early days. What would you do the day, let's say you pitch the complete game, even in the minor leagues, what would you do the next day? Take us through the routine before you pitched again.
You'd run your butt off the next day. This was the Coleman influence, and maybe my dad. You know, there are poisons that are developed in your system when you use muscles so that you have stiffness. And the only way you're going to get rid of that stiffness is through your blood system. So if you sweat, you get rid of some of that stuff. And we were taught to run. And the day after I pitched, I'd run my tail off in the outfield.
Now, we see pitchers today running in the outfield, but they are barely breaking a sweat. I mean, I can run. I'm crippled, and I can run faster than they do.
We used to run hard.
You ran wind sprints.
Well, not wind sprints, but we'd have somebody with a fungo bat and hit fly balls that you chased. And we had coaches that were always able to hit that ball about 1 foot in front of where you could possibly get. So you're going to make up that 1 foot, never did.
Yeah.
But yeah, we did a lot of running, and I think it's important to run for a cause. And after all, this is baseball, you run to catch the baseball. Today they run wind sprints. You know, it's just like our kids that things were great when we were young, but now when something in that same area is awesome, you know, it's a connotation. Yeah. And then the second day after
that, would you pitch? Would you throw at all on the first day after you pitch?
Not likely.
No.
Get rid of the stiffness.
Would you play pepper?
Yeah.
So you throw a little bit.
Yeah.
Playing pepper.
And then the second day you throw batting practice. And I think that was good because you concentrate on control, getting the ball where you want to get it, or let the guy hit it, but it's establishing that rhythm to get the ball in the strike zone. And then the third day, I don't think I threw a whole lot, but then I was ready to pitch again.
Well, this routine, it sounds like the line between your father and the manager at Indiana, very important. Was he second most influential person in terms of building habits, good habits within you at that point, Coleman?
Oh, yes. I think Bob Coleman was a fine man to work for. He was a father image that we were on the road, and he used to dole out the meal money. You'd have to go in every day and get your meal money from him. And then he'd say, "When did you write your mother last?" And, you know, if you didn't write your mother, you better go upstairs and write your mother. So those are good traits and good habits. And he was a family-oriented person, and I think he cared about the people that worked for him, ball players, and he treated them like they're his children, which I think is a good trait. And every prospect they had in the Braves organization, they sent to Bob Coleman.
Now, Bob Feller will tell you that he never spent a second in the minor leagues. Robin Roberts told us he spent 11 games in the minor leagues. You were there for a while. What can you tell us the difference between major league life as you found it when you hit the big time and minor league life? I mean, it's a different world, I assume.
I think the difference was in my mind's eye. I can remember when I first came up to the big leagues that, Braves Field, you know, was a pretty old stadium, but that was the big leagues to me. And when I first pitched in the big leagues, I thought, wow, you know, those guys are big leaguers, and I wonder if I have to change the way I pitch. I remember Ernie Lombardi was one of the catchers that I pitched to. And again, traits. I was taught to waste a pitch, and I remember I threw a pitch outside to Ernie, and he was so big and clumsy that instead of catching the ball with the glove, which is this, he stuck his bare hand out and caught. And he chewed tobacco and he spit on the ball, rubbed it up, and he threw it sidearm to me harder than I threw it to him. And I thought, if that's the way catchers pitch throw in the big league, I don't belong. So I think success, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? And I think you have to be successful before you're confident. And you have to be confident to be successful. So they're hand in hand. So I think you develop those things as you go along. And I remember, wow, you know, I remember the first ball game I won in the big leagues. I was on high cotton. I was on cloud nine. I felt that the world was my oyster and that I couldn't wait to get back out there.
Now that was after the war. I want to go back to the beginning of the war. I mean, Pearl Harbor, you're a young kid. You obviously thought you were going to have to go in the service. Tell me your reactions when, obviously it was in December, it's in the off season. What was your reaction when the war started?
Well, I remember when war was declared, and I certainly was eligible, and I certainly felt that I was going to be drafted, and I was scared to death. I didn't want to go, I didn't want to be a soldier, but I was drafted. And again, if I'm a soldier, I wanted to be the best soldier I could possibly be. If I'm a pitcher, I want to be the best pitcher I could be. So I think those traits fit along that sideline. And I remember when I was drafted, the recruiter said, what did I do in civilian life? And I said, I was a professional ball player. And they said, what the heck are we going to do with you? So they put me the 14th Armored Division. You know, Army, if you were a truck driver, they made a baker out of you. And if you were a baker, they made a truck driver. They wanted to teach you their way. Yeah. And so I wound up in the 14th Armored Division. And then the Army streamlined the Armored Division. And I was in D Company. And they streamlined it to headquarters A, B, and C Company. So they took all the people in D Company and established the Combat Engineer Battalions. And E Company was a bridge company, so that they made it a separate unit. At any rate, I wound up as a combat engineer. And a combat engineer is one that digs holes and does all the dirty work that nobody else wants to do. But again, I was a good teacher.
I want to go back and you got drafted in 1942.
Yes.
Did you go to spring training that year in 42 with the Braves?
No. No, the season, well, let me go back. My birthday is in April, and I was eligible to be drafted of April 1942. And I got a deferment to finish my baseball season. But the minute the season was over, boy, they grabbed me. I was in the service.
So you played 42?
Yes.
In the minors? I thought you were with the Braves in 42.
I was.
And briefly.
I was. And we're playing the Dodgers, and the Dodgers always beat the devil out of us. And the Dodgers also got our signs from second base and relayed them to the hitter. And I remember that Casey was going to have a switch. And one was going to be the curveball and two the fastball. And Pee Wee Reese was the hitter. And Casey gave me the knockdown pitch. And I threw inside, and I think I threw back here, and Pee Wee just moved his head out of the way. And Casey jumped up, and when he did, he hit his head on the top of the dugout that was concrete. Now he's real mad. And he gave me the knockdown again, and I threw here and missed him. So Casey came out to the mound, and he said, "Young man, you don't have any guts. I'm gonna send you to Hartford to get some." I was gone the next day. So I finished the season in Hartford.
And then, yeah. And what was the knockdown sign? I mean, how did he do it? He just gave you a sign from the dugout and...
Yeah, you know, knock him down.
Yeah.
And of course, Pee Wee was pretty agile, and of all the guys with the Dodgers, why he knocked Pee Wee down, but we were going to retaliate for them getting the signs from second base. And he was irate at the time, and he sent me out. And I finished the season with Hartford, and I think I wound up 17-12.
That was a good team, though. Was Tommy Holmes there?
No. No, Tommy was already with the big league club. We had a terrible team.
You had a great quote about, "I played for Casey Stengel before and after. He was a genius."
Well, I said that at Cooperstown when I was inducted.
Yeah.
And Casey was sitting behind me. And I said that I played for Casey Stengel before and after. He was a genius because he was a genius with the Yankees.
Yeah, that's right.
And then I finished my career with the Mets in New York, and he certainly was no genius then.
Can you talk about him? The 75 years from now, he's a name that people will be interested in. Obviously, Hall of Fame manager with the Yankees and later with the Mets. And you saw him with the Braves. Talk a little bit about Casey as a kid. Now, obviously, you had an experience with him that wasn't terrific, but I'm interested in your views of Stengel.
Well, Casey was a great showman. He was a great ambassador for baseball. Casey'd stay up all night as long as there was somebody in the lobby of the hotel to hear his stories. And he was a great double talker, so that you had to hang with him because you didn't know what he was talking about. And he'd be up early in the morning to talk to whoever wanted to talk baseball again.
How would you rate him as a manager?
Oh, I think he was very clever. I think Casey, probably one of the people that started switching left versus right and right versus left. I think that he cultivated Allie Reynolds as a starter and a reliever. He used to get Hank Bauer so crazy because he wanted to play every day, and he knew just exactly when Hank Bauer was ready to go over the edge, and then he put him in the ballgame. And so I think he was a great strategist, genius. I think players make managers, but it's certainly a good influence to have a good manager.
Did you hold any grudge against him for that? That it seemed like precipitous move to send you down because you didn't hit
Pee Wee. No, not at all. I probably felt that I deserved it. Interesting sideline to Casey. We played in the World Series in 57 and 58, and I pitched a two-hit shutout against the Yankees in Yankee Stadium, and my father was there. After the game was over, I went to look for my dad, and I couldn't find him. And I finally decided he went his way or whatever, and I got back to the hotel. and my dad was in the lobby, and he didn't tell me this, but Casey Stengel told me this many years ago, and he said, you ought to be very proud of your father. And I said, well, I am. He said, well, my father came back after that ball game, and he grabbed Casey, who was a pretty big man. My father was a little guy. Grabbed him by the front of his shirt, and he's going to beat the heck out of him because he sent me out. You know, and he said, now who has no guts? And Casey himself told me that story. Yeah. And my father never said anything about that. But that's the pride that my dad had in me. And kind of like I couldn't afford to let him down.
Tell us about the team as you joined them in that 42 season with the Braves. Who was on the team? Was Lombardi there? Was he catching?
He came later. Golly, I wonder if I can repeat.
You told me a wonderful story once about one of the Wainers.
Oh, your Paul Lloyd. Or Paul,
you
yeah.
roomed with him, right?
Oh,
and you told me a story.
I can't tell you this story.
It's a great story for history. You can tell a story.
Well, When I was a rookie and went to spring training, Paul Wainer was my roommate. And Paul was a Maverick, so I guess not too many people wanted to room with him. And he used to come to spring training in an old beat-up Model A, and he'd have his fishing equipment there rather than his baseball stuff. And in the morning, we woke up, and we had to be at the ballpark, and we had to walk to the ballpark. That was part of our training. And Paul reached under his bed and grabbed a pint, and he took a sip, and I guess my eyeballs went through the roof because, I didn't think ballplayers should do that. But anyway, Paul recognized that, and he said, now look, he says, this is our secret. And he says, I have astigmatism. And he said, if I don't have a drink before I go to the ballpark, I see two balls and I don't know which one to hit. He said, but when I have a drink, then I see one big ball. And I think maybe Paul might have believed that.
We should say a word about Paul Wainer, though. He was a Hall of Fame ball player.
Great
and
ball
a terrific
player.
Hitter with his brother for Pittsburgh. Big poison, a little poison, and somehow he managed to overcome that problem. But you came along at a time when drinking in baseball was relatively common. I mean, there was a lot of it, and a lot of good ball players hurt themselves.
Oh,
what,
sure.
What kept you from getting caught up in that life?
Well, I don't know. First of all, I couldn't afford it, probably. And
does it go back to your father again and the values?
Well, yes, but I'm of German descent, and being in depression, whatever. My father always had a pitcher of beer on our dinner table. And, we didn't know that beer was alcoholic. And we couldn't afford milk, so that we had beer. And so that I was a beer drinker all the time that I played, not to a great extent. But I also felt that chemically, that alcohol had to change seven different times before it gets out of your system if you drink alcohol, or at least bourbon, whiskey, whatever. And that beer was more water than anything, you could sweat it out. That was another reason for running. And but what the other guys did didn't really matter to me. It's what I did with my life and what I did with my career. And I know many people said, don't do what Spahn does. I used to throw from the outfield like an outfielder just to stretch my arm out, but I knew it was good for me. And managers say, don't do what that silly Sawagun does. But I never had a sore arm.
Who did you pal around with the first year on the Braves? Did you have a roommate? Or I mean, now you roomed with Wainer a little bit, but who were your buddies on that team your first year?
Oh, I think the guys that came up from Evansville, probably Bill Donovan, a left-handed pitcher, a little left-hander that came out of Kentucky. It was class distinction in those days. The major, guys that were regulars, they hung together and get out of here, little kid. We were the, we were the young kids, and we probably stuck together.
All right, go ahead.
I was just going to go back to something you said that I was curious about when you were talking about your father and Casey, and you said you're almost afraid to let him down. The early years of your career, were you pitching as much for your father and your family as yourself? I mean, it was obviously his dream for you. How important was that?
Wow, that's a good question. Self-preservation, probably. But also, you know, within the Spahn family, my granddaughter, who is here, my son, is that we had a prophecy in our family, don't embarrass the family. And I think, you know, that brings out the best of you to determine the difference between right and wrong. It's a matter of standards. And it might be okay for Johnny to do that. I remember when my son was going to high school, he wanted me to buy a boat, and one of his friend's father had a boat. And, you know, I told him, I said, we can't afford it. And 6 months later, that guy lost that boat because he couldn't pay for it. And it was a lesson. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the way we did our lifestyle, is that I don't care what the Joneses do, but this is the way we're going to do it.
Warren, I want to take you to the war years, because you were one of the baseball people who had a very distinguished career in that war. And keeping in mind that people watching this may be watching it 50 years from now, tell us, I want to spend some time on this because I think it's important for history. You were a big league ball player, and you know you're about to join the Army. For generations that will come after us, the question is, how committed were you to the service? Why were you so willing to go? What was the feeling?
I wasn't willing to go. I was drafted. But my country was in trouble. And I think we all felt, and I think that generation felt, that we had an obligation, and that we'd rather fight Hitler over in Europe than have him invade this country. So that everybody dropped what they were doing to preserve what we felt America was all about and our style of living. So that, you know, it wasn't a case that I'm going to lose a year or two or even my life, but that it was something you have to do, and it was an obligation. And I didn't enjoy being a soldier, but if I was going to be a soldier, I wanted to be the best I could.
So there was no feeling that I want to do something to avoid this service, maybe I can pull some strings and duck out of it. None of that was involved in
your... Well, Faye, let me correct you. When I went in the service, I was a rookie. So I didn't have the status of a Bob Feller or other people that were established. I was just another doughboy. And you know, I wound up in Combat Engineer Battalion. I went to Europe in Combat Engineers. I dug ditches and cleaned up minefields and all those sort of things, like everybody else did. And I thought, I don't want to do this. And I remember when I got to be a PFC and a corporal, I thought I wanted to do that because I didn't have to do KP, which is kitchen police, you know, peeling potatoes. And I think that each of the times that I got a promotion, I got away from the low level of the Army. So I became a corporal, a sergeant, a staff sergeant, and then I got a battlefield commission.
Can
you're one
you
of the few.
Can you explain that phrase? Can you explain that for people who might not understand?
Well, battlefield commission, when we captured the bridge over the Remagen Bridge, we lost a lot of people, including officers, so that they needed replacement people for these officers we lost. And my company commander recommended me as being a potential officer. And I went to school in England for like 3 weeks, a crash course, and I became an officer. But then I was an officer in charge of the same guys that I work with, which is tough. And I remember my best buddy, Roy Ryman from Buffalo, I woke him up to put my bars on me when I got my commission, and he laughed at me. And you know, we two guys played ball together, came from Buffalo together and whatever. And it's tradition that your best friend puts your bars on you. And I had a heck of a time getting him to salute me. And I said, remember, you're saluting the uniform.
Take us to your first, you went to Europe. When did you get to Europe? What time?
Wow.
After D-Day, obviously.
Yes, very much. And we were stationed in England, Yeovil Junction, a little old tiny place in England. And then we actually weren't committed into the fight until the Battle of the Bulge.
Which was in December of 1944 in Belgium. Okay. And you got there about that time. The 101st was there.
We were there surrounded. With the 101st, the 82nd.
And you got overrun at Bastogne at the time the Bulge occurred, which is around just before Christmas of 44.
Right, you're great. You know more about the dates than I do. I remember one time we were surrounded by the Germans.
At Bastogne.
And I think so.
Yeah.
And I remember that the password we had among us is that who played the Keystone sack for the Dodgers. Well, any German wouldn't know that. That was American lingo. And God help the guy that didn't know who played second base for the Dodgers.
There was a lot of infiltration, right?
Were they dressed up?
The Battle of Bulge, a lot of German infiltration.
Well, you didn't know if the guy next to you was German or American.
The Germans dressed. They captured Americans and used the uniforms.
They had all of our uniforms.
And they passed themselves on.
They had our dog tags. They had our equipment.
Yeah.
Yes. And Hitler would have been successful, I think, had he not stretched himself out so far as supply line.
Now, I mentioned earlier to you there was a massacre at Malmedy, and you said you were there. Do you have memories of what happened there?
Oh, I sure do. Our people were slaughtered. And we were with the 82nd and the 101st, and I remember those paratroopers. I mean, they were merciless. And they might have slaughtered more Germans than we lost Americans. Yeah. They were a tough bunch.
And then Patton and others came along and...
We hated Patton.
Tell us about that.
Well, just the fact, I was in the First Army. And again, I was in a combat engineer battalion so that we had no mother to protect us like, a division. We were just attached to